At the June 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, Dr. Catherine Tom, RSJ, presented an account of the distinctive lives of Josephites of the New South Wales province in the years 1968 to 2008. Sister Catherine is introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Now to today's speaker, Dr. Catherine Tom. Catherine is a Josephite sister and has provided me with some biographical details by way of introduction. So I'll read you what she said because it can't be abbreviated anymore and it's an extraordinary curriculum vitae. She writes, I have been in education from the 1960s, beginning in secondary schools before moving to the tertiary sector. There I began in religious education but soon moved to the theology and philosophy faculty when ACU became a university. My majors were always in history, so I could justify moving out of religious education. My first study leave in 1986 to 88 saw me at Heythrop College Theology Faculty of the University of London as a visiting scholar, the first of a few times, where I taught an MA group of international students a 12-week course on Aboriginal spirituality. I must confess, she goes on, my fear when I knew that a number of the Jesuit staff had decided to attend the course. But this experience confirmed my passion for history at this academic level. Dr. Gideon Goosen constantly encouraged all staff to keep updating their qualifications, so I owe a great deal to Gideon. And that's one of the things about tertiary education. If you're lucky, you meet somebody who inspires you and changes your life, and it happened to me. But increasingly at our corporate universities, I think that's unlikely. So we're selling our students short in many ways. However, to go on, I've been chugging along at other institutions and with periodic attendance at conferences in Australia and overseas since the 1960s. I have two projects to complete before I depart this mortal life, digitising the earlier history of New South Wales province and my own memoir, Eagles Fly Alone. So today Catherine will speak about it. She's brought along a couple of copies of it, and anybody who's got a spare $25 and is interested, they're available for sale. She's going to be speaking about her intriguingly titled history, From Taproot to Rhizome, What You Never Knew About Women Religious Lives in Australia, 1968 to 2008. I'm delighted to welcome Catherine Tom to speak to us all.
Thanks very much for that. I have a confession to make about this presentation. As we've just been told, it says something about what you never were told about religious women. I think there's probably a place for this in our conversations in the Roman Catholic Church, but I'm always perplexed at the lack of knowledge of other members of the laity about religious women. I shouldn't be surprised because students where I taught in a country school for 6 years used to always say, but we know nothing about what you do. And I said, but you live among us. They were all boarders, of course. Still didn't make any difference. Today I may be doing something about, I will quote what some of our sisters have said. But basically it's looking at what the commissioning provincial Judy Sipple asked me to do. I think she probably got a bit of encouragement by the fact that my doctoral thesis was published in London in 2003. I don't think Judy knew whether I could write a sentence. She's a highly skilled lady, I might add. We had two histories. The first one was Cath Burford's, and it was called Unfurrowed Fields, 1872 to 1972. She concentrated on those 100 years, but she didn't do much about Vatican II. My thesis on the 6th to 8th century Irish monasticism could be almost said to be an objective history, because I didn't live through those 6th to 8th centuries. But in this book, I did live through it all. The Irish influence in the Catholic Church actually dictated to us that all the rules we lived by were actually based on the Irish monastic rules. And when I was doing that study in Ireland, I had the rules there with me, and I could almost see us doing exactly, and the words were exactly the same, what the Irish monastic rules were demanding of those monks in the 6th to 8th century, I might add. We're talking about the 21st and the 20th century here. So we actually fasted from certain foods on certain days in honour of certain saints, and that was fruit on Wednesday in honour of St. Joseph. Not too sure what the link was, but we were always doing fasting based on the Irish monastic rules, but they did relate to saints. We had fasting on Friday, and it wasn't only fish either, meat. We had a rule which said we had to genuflect, I might add, go on bended knee to our superior to get a blessing when we left the house and when we came back. It became a bob later, but earlier it was a genuflection. So all of the rules by which we lived were based on the Irish monastic rules, and probably that's based on the fact that the Australian church was based on the Irish rules. With this book, however, From Taproot to Rhizome, a study of post-Vatican II changes in the lives and experiences of a group of women religious, 1968 to 2008, I was not an outsider. I was up to my neck in it. I was in the midst of all the challenges, sharing in the anguish, the pain, the excitement, and our eventual re-emergence as post-Vatican II religious. I must say that what I'm going to say has probably been experienced by many other religious congregations too. I don't know whether they've been bold enough or stupid enough to write it down. And that's why I will apologise. I'm not negative, and I do not dislike the Josephites at all. I've been here for 60-something years, so I'm still hanging in. But I always believe that unless we tell the truth, we're living hypocritical lives. I really do. So when Judy commissioned the work, and Judy Sipple was the commissioning provincial, she was provincial in New South Wales from 2006 to 2008. She gave me two focuses. Firstly, what differentiated New South Wales from all other provinces in the congregation, which is very insightful actually at that stage. Secondly, she asked me to chart the changes that were spearheaded by Vatican II and analyse the effect on our lives. What you may not know is that in our congregation, a province is the equivalent of the states. So New South Wales province was New South Wales state. Queensland province was Queensland state. It got a bit mixed up later on when we got big. New Zealand, of course, was an appendage. But don't ever tell them that I said that, because they've always wanted to secede from the empire. They've been doing it all their lives. Not too sure why, but there's always been this sense that if there wasn't a New Zealander on the congregational leadership team, that something happened at the chapter, you see. No one knows what the something was, but it happened. So to follow Judy's suggestion, I chose 8 significant differences between New South Wales and other provinces of the congregation. I chose them. Judy didn't have anything to say about them, actually. And I put them where I wanted them to go for a particular reason, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Each of the sections, section 1, 2 and 3, was prefaced by a prologue, and that was based on Kevin Dance, I think, said any history you write should be written in the context of world and Australian events. So in that prologue, I talked about the things that were happening in the world and in Australia, and linked it to 3 poems that came from Noel Meehan's Book of Stories. It's a beautiful book, profound book of stories, actually. So in section 1, I've got 3 chapters. One is the evolution and understanding of the notion of provinces, because that's really important. A province is just not New South Wales and the geographic region at all. In Mary MacKillop's mind in the 1860s, she said, a sister who was a provincial outside the mother colony, which was Adelaide, needs far more power than any sister within the mother colony. Now, that's interesting in terms of New South Wales, because they never had any power. So I really thought that the first chapter had to be on the understanding of province. By the way, everything comes from canon law, so we don't really have much movement except when we come to our customs. Secondly, I looked at the multicultural Josephites in New South Wales. And these two topics I deliberately put in section one. And I did that because I thought it was really important to understand the notion of province and also understand who we were in a multicultural society. Because I sensed, and Judy also sensed, that there was something awry in how we kind of accepted other nationalities. And I'll come to that with Megalogenesis' comment in a minute. The third chapter in section one was on St Margaret's Hospital. Now, none of these things I'm talking about happened in any other province of the congregation. Section two addresses the changes initiated by Vatican II, as evident in the records of our provincial and congregational chapters. We always had a provincial chapter about 12 months before a congregational chapter. So this book, Taproot to Rhizome, was taken, the title was taken from a book called Green Sisters. It's written by Sarah McFarlane Taylor in about 2007. And I didn't get this topic, this heading, until many, 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 many years. I might add, I started this in 2003. And it was published 22. Took a long, long time. The gestation means that it's better than it would have been if I'd given it the first time. And Ed Campion, I must say to Ed, I was looking and I was uncomfortable with it. And I don't even know what year it was, Ed, that I met you or rang you and said, look, I've got this history. I don't have much confidence in blah, blah, blah. Could you just have a look at two chapters? So Ed looked at the first chapter and about the fourth chapter or something, and he put his finger straight on what it was that made me uncomfortable. So I went ahead and I then read others, and then I went and rewrote the whole early part. So this book called Green Sisters, From Taproot to Rhizome, that's my choice of it, Sarah McFarlane Taylor says, although the rhizome is strong and tenacious, its strength does not emanate from the central source. Instead, it comes both from its organic decentralisation and lateral structure, which provides it with flexibility to adapt quickly to new conditions. The cover, I think it's quite beautiful, actually. One of our Victorian sisters, she was the artist who did all the drawings for Mary MacKillop for her beatification and canonisation. In the early years when we were negotiating with Rome about Mary's beatification, I happened to be at Mount Street, and they sent a photo over that we might use as an inspiration for the Australian population, and it was absolutely ghastly. It had roses around me, and roses all falling down here, and rosary beads everywhere, and one of the sisters said, what do you think about this? I said, it's absolute garbage. It really was terrible. And I had found a photo of Mary MacKillop in a godforsaken place that I loved dearly, in Tinga. And it was in 1967 I found it in a corner cupboard. And it was a sepia, a beautiful, genuine sepia. And I took it down to the archivist in Sydney, when I eventually went down to Sydney. And she said, can I have it? And I said, no, it's mine. So I kept it. I'm embarrassed about that now. But eventually I gave it to her, and that's the photo we use for everything. And we sent it to Rome, and we said, this or nothing. They mightn't have said it as crudely as that, but in actual fact, that's what it was. We use this photo, or we don't use anything. So this Therese had done these, and Therese's response to me was, when I sent it down to her, by the way, Domenica, the lady who does the graphic designing for St Paul's, is a brilliant woman, actually. And she had the rhizome as black, and I said, no, I said, this is about life, it's about growth. No, you can't have black. So this is what she ended up with. And when I sent it to Therese, darling, Therese takes a long time to answer an email, and she wrote back and she said, Catherine, the soil is fresh. And I think she's right. This is what an artist would say. The soil is fresh. Anyway, I had a two-hour conversation with Therese the other day because she's just finished reading the books, you see, from October. But that's Therese. I'm really pleased with this because what it's saying is that we went through all the pain of that taproot leadership to now be on a rhizome of responsibility for all of us. Section 3 contains a variety of smaller differences. So we've got the differences in the first one. Section 3 is more differences, and the middle section is the discussion of the chapters provincial and congregational chapters. So some of the smaller issues, they're not really small, but they're smaller, sisters caring for the apostolic delegate and his staff, now that's the story all on its own. Unbelievable. I never had the privilege of working there, luckily, because the apostolic delegate would have heard from me exactly what I thought. But there were a number of sisters over a number of years who lived there. They had to watch telly with them of a night time, which had been horrific, actually. And when it came big events, some other sisters, either the novices in the early days or the student sisters, had to go and help them, you know, do the walls and clean the, wash the things. And the second one here I've got is Josephites in Tertiary Education, the Gregorian Scholar. New South Wales becomes a legal entity, and that's really important, in Judy's time, 2007, and the beatification of Mary MacKillop. Now, there are other little things within that section. So as part of this three-section structure, I began each section with a poem, as I said before, from Noel's book. What I found fascinating is that no one ever commented to me on the poems, because to me they were setting the scene for what we were going to read about. What was equally puzzling and very pleasing to me were the effusive comments from so many sisters by phone, in person and email. Now, anyone who lives in an institutional setting knows very well that one does not usually get compliments in such an atmosphere. In case you get too proud, and in spiritual parlance, it's called keeping you humble. So I was staggered by a phone call I had the other day, one of the sisters saying, I didn't get your book. Can I have a copy? The point about this one is that it was their story. The personal stories of New South Wales Josephites that made all the difference to the way they received the book. Now I'm returning to section one. Looking at the evolution of the New South Wales province, it has to be noted that in our short life we went from one to two to three to four and back to one province. From our beginning in 1883 when Mary MacKillop was thrown out of South Australia and came to New South Wales. In New South Wales, beginning, there's only one province, but as the number of sisters, ministries and convents grew, New South Wales eventually got more provinces. I need to say to you about Armidale. The two Quinn brothers, one was in Queensland and one was in Perthville or Bathurst. They were thorns in Mary's side the whole time. She took some sisters, about 20 to 30 eventually, to Brisbane, and there was so much fuss up there that she had to bring them out. In the meantime, Bishop Torrigiani arrived in Armidale, so he took all the sisters from Queensland. So the first province we ended up with was having Armidale-Lismore. Then we had Wollongong, Canberra-Goulburn, Wilcannia-Forbes as another provincial area, and the third one was Sydney. Probably the most painful experience for the sisters in New South Wales was the existence of two levels of authority. And this is where you'll get all the comments later. Congregational Leadership Team, the CLT, and the Provincial Leadership Team, the PLT. There was a sister in South Australia who came to live in New South Wales and was in a lot of positions in education. I talked a lot with Mary because I valued her comments. And at one stage she wrote this: thinking about your focus on the effect of the Sydney provinces made me reflect yet again on the ambiguities and impact, personal and collective, of a situation which was unique to New South Wales, namely the very real influence of the physical location of and the constant exercise of authority by the generalate. This was quantitatively and qualitatively different in New South Wales from what it was in any other province. And that's the comments I'm going to read you in a minute, are based on that distinction between the provinces. What's obvious when looking at the provincial chapter notes and the congregational chapter notes was the evidence that New South Wales provincials had no power whatsoever, because the power could be and often was overridden by the Superior General. They never gave a report to chapter till late in 1970. And remember, we started in 1883 in New South Wales, so it wasn't until 1970 that the New South Wales provincials could give a report to chapter on their province. The Superior General did it all the time. Provincial went through the charade of sending in the list of changes for her particular province at the end of each year. One provincial said to me, "I never recognised the list when it came back from North Sydney." Which is, anyway, they're supposed to have more power, according to Mary McKillop. As Sydney grew, it was divided between, this is hilarious, between North and South Sydney, separated by the Hume Highway. So sisters in Bankstown, southern Sydney, were in a different province from the sisters in Lidcombe, the northern province, a distance of about 10 minutes by car. Even between the different Sydney provinces, different rules applied to sisters living, mainly according to one sister, depending on the style of leadership of the provincial. In the north, and these are really important things, in the north you could wear sandals in the chapel, wear skirts and blouses, go to the movies. Really important aspects of religious living, you would agree. In the south, none of these things were possible or permitted. Two blood sisters, the Hickeys, lived in different Sydney provinces, and their family said they could have belonged to different congregations. In some provinces, a sister could do renewal courses, but in another, this was not supported. Secondary schools with the allocation of staff were fraught, because it was thought that the city schools were given priority over the country schools. If a sister, me and others, was not appointed to Milperra, a quintessentially Josephite school, we thought we were second-class citizens. All the above issues seem to be insignificant aspects of religious life and not worthy of comment. But to those who lived through these deprivations, they were serious. With hindsight, we all find them sources of humour. We joke about it all the time. But it wasn't funny when you lived through it. Because, Bankstown and Lidcombe, you were just next-door neighbours. I have to admit that I lived in all four provinces at one time or another, and I never felt I didn't belong. But some sisters did, and one of them got a very, very clear memory of something. The third chapter in section one was multicultural. And I just want to read you something from Megalogenus on his notion of xenophobia, because he talks about, he just gives a history. Our history teaches us that sectarianism is the strand of xenophobia that is the hardest to overcome. The Irish Catholics were at the WOG whipping post for half a century, from the conscription referendum of World War I to the argument over state aid that ended in 1960. Leaders such as Billy Hughes helped fan the flames of anti-Catholicism, and leaders ultimately doused them. When Robert Menzies provided funding for the non-government schools for the first time in 64, the opinion polls found 8 out of 10 Catholics in favour, but 51% of Protestants opposed. The Greeks and the Italians had about 30 years on the outer, 20 years fewer than the Catholics, from the end of World War II to the arrival of the first Vietnamese boat people in the mid-70s. The Asian waves were integrated faster still, even though some politicians in the late 80s questioned their ability to be absorbed. The Lebanese have become the surrogate for Australia's fear of Islam, even though less than half of the Lebanese Australians are Muslims. It's politics that will be the most influential in shaping how quickly this wave of xenophobia passes. I found that interesting to look up the definition of xenophobia, which is a fear of foreigners and a fear of others. I had that quite clearly as a kid. I went to Bathurst to play a tennis competition with my younger sister. We were only 1312 or something. And my cousin we stayed with, Anne, she'd married a Polish man, Stan. I was absolutely petrified for the whole 3 weeks I was there. When Stan was away at work, I was okay. He didn't do anything to me. It was just that I was absolutely frightened of the foreigner. I don't know why I would have been, because I was living in Leichhardt, so, you know, there were Italians there, and they're still there, and they're still talking Italian. But I somehow grew up, and I don't mind anymore. But I don't know how much that feeds into racism, and I'm not even going into that at all. When praying the office of a morning, morning or evening, whichever you choose, we go through the list of the sisters who are dead. And when for this, I went through and checked all their heritage. And it's amazing the number of Germans in our congregation. But they're certainly outnumbered by the Irish. And the Irish are... well, there's a very good map in there, a very good diagram in there showing that the Irish came in their hundreds in the early 1860s, 70s, 80s. And then they came again in their hundreds in the 50s and 60s. They don't come at all now, but it doesn't really matter. I never really understood the Irish. I don't know whether that's right or wrong. I used to think they lied, and I said that to one of the sisters one day. And I didn't understand what it was until I was doing my thesis. And Mary Shamil was saying something about a metaphorical mindset, that some Irish actually talk at two levels. And that's the way I understood it as lying. And I remember I've got a very dear friend who's an Episcopal chap, and I used to say to him, "For God's sake, tell me the truth. Do you know Fred or do you not?" And he got to a stage of saying, "I met him once," or, "Yes, I think I was introduced to him twice," or something. But it was my lack of understanding of the richness of the Irish culture. So one Province Day we had in Anne Derwin's time, after we became one, 1983, in 1984, Anne asked some sisters to tell us about their culture. Now, I heard four of them. And one sister said, and I can still hear her saying it, "I longed for an olive." And all of a sudden I thought, that's a terrible bit of deprivation. Like, she longed for an olive. You know, and here she was in the Australian context. We never ate olives. But it helped me understand culture. And that's the reason why I seriously wanted to put this multicultural section. Because in that second section, chapter, I've got the Irish sisters' stories that I wrote under the title of Heroines in a Harsh Landscape. I've got excerpts of their stories there, because the pain and deprivation of migration is something we do not understand, Josephites. And the Asian sisters are also there, and they're all telling their stories too. And funnily enough, when I talk to some of the Asian sisters and talking about food and the olive, two of them said to me, "Look, when we used to have to cook for the Asians, the Australian sisters, we kind of put in less garlic and less spices because they couldn't cope with that." So it's like cultural understanding and misunderstanding actually gets to the guts of your food, which is what I feel we need to say. It's important for me to say too that some of these sisters who came to us, Vietnamese sisters, around about in the 1970s, I don't know whether you remember that photo of them coming at the airbase at Richmond, Father King, Mara's father, and there are all these little Vietnamese sisters coming with one little bag with all their life's clothing in it. They were taken to our novitiate at Baulkham Hills, and they lived there for quite some time. And one of the novices, Rosemary, wrote, and in it she's got, in here I've got about four or five pages, of her telling of the effort of the sisters to try and understand each other. And she said one of the most telling thing was they were walking down the great drive we had. I don't know whether they were trying to teach each other English and whatever, but a car backfired. And she said they just went like that. They just all disappeared. And by the time they got up, and came back together, Rosemary hadn't a clue why they'd done it. But it was because they'd just come out of a war, you know, and we didn't understand that, and they couldn't tell us that. So it's really important for us to try and... So that's why it's there. Judy was very conscious of the potential for misunderstanding when some of those sisters who came from Vietnam wanted to join our order. We have quite a number of them in New South Wales. And Judy was hesitant, and in the end she said to the whole province, any sister who wants to go home with these Vietnamese or Cambodian or whoever, whatever nationality they are, if you want to go home, when they go home, you can go with them. Now, I have a nagging question here which says, why did only 15 sisters take up the offer of going to Vietnam and Cambodia? I don't know. I know my answer. But it's really interesting that it's still very deeply there. When Hun, our Cambodian sister, who's scarily intelligent, she wanted to take her Cambodian friends to on holiday, on pilgrimage. And Judy said, well, take Kath Tom, she knows something about pilgrimage. So we did, and we went to Vietnam and Cambodia. And to me, Hun's contribution to the congregation, New South Wales, is absolutely profound. Because she, if you ask her about... She was a Buddhist, and then met two of our sisters, Margaret and Teresa, in Piemont, mixing with all the gays. They were a funny pair. They're in their 90s, and they used to go down to the pub every, you know, weekend or week or whatever it was, and the pub gave them the fellas in the pub gave them television and all the things they ever needed, and they were a beautiful pair of women. Anyway, Hun met them when she was living in Piemont, and she became a Catholic and she entered. And I said to her one day, what's conversion? Well, I've never heard anyone so profound in telling me what it meant to come from Buddhism, and it wasn't just to Catholicism or Christianity. It was Christianity building on Buddhism. That was exactly the way she understood it. Now, I put that in here so that the sisters would understand that notion of conversion, which I think is quite profound. But I'm only up to the third chapter in the first section. It's on multiculturalism, and it's on St Margaret's Hospital. And the only thing I want to say about that, and there's someone here who understands this, Mary O'Brien, an Irish woman, entered in Adelaide with Mary MacKillop, subsequently wanted to found a congregation which was... a contemplative congregation. So she left, and at the same time there were a couple of sisters who were fiddling around with the jam on the altar and all sorts of things like that, and Mary pragmatically, Julian thought that they were saints and they were mystics, and Mary knew what they were, and she just said they had to leave, and they came to Sydney and met up with Mary O'Brien, who turned out to call herself Gertrude Abbott, simply because women couldn't get money to buy houses in those days. And they really founded St Margaret's Hospital. I don't want to go into that. What I'd like to do is read to you now some of the things the sisters are saying, mainly about the two provinces in Sydney. The rest of the comments are in the second section, where the sisters reflect on the changes that were were coming out of the chapters. And they're very frank. They are as frank in those comments as they are in these. One sister said that while the actual boundaries between provinces was clearly delineated, it actually divided what was historically, what has historically been experienced as a unity, geographic and social. I think this would have had an impact at any time, and particularly when there was such a ferment of change going on in individuals and community. This dear sister says, the next one says, I remember one New South Wales Province Day, it was the Northern Province only, had booked St Joseph's College, Hunters Hill, for Province Day. All the sisters arrived for the day. I went for a walk and saw the sisters just across the road, and I was not part of that group of Josephites. I was so upset, I was hurt, I didn't belong. I never belonged to the Armidale-Lismore province. She's in Hunters Hill. Here we were in Hunters Hill, right in the middle of Sydney, and we didn't belong. Many sisters commented on this marriage of convenience, these are my words, and the odd coupling. But the frankest one is, the only thought I remember thinking was how ridiculous it was to have all those sisters in Hunters Hill named as belonging to the Armidale-Lismore province. I thought it was cracked. I remember feeling bad about it, that it was manipulative or something tricky. Now, the reason for that is that in the country district, most of the sisters were young. And in Sydney, at Hunters Hill and places like that, they were senior sisters. So in order to balance the voting, someone, in their wisdom, just said, well, we'll put Hunters Hill into Armidale-Lismore. You don't have to move. It's just that when Armidale-Lismore does any voting, Hunters Hill does it too. And the other one was Leichhardt, St Martha's Leichhardt, where I've lived twice. They were put into the Wollongong Canberra Goulburn Diocese for the same reason. Now, this sister was really frank. She said, I thought it was cracked. I remember feeling bad about it and it was manipulative and something tricky. We tell the truth, don't we? But I understand why it happened. Her frankness here is also evident in other comments. One sister who lived at Milperra in the period quite seriously said in the hearing of the community that she welcomed the sisters from the country visiting because they were our wholesome brethren. And I said, like, was this naivety or did she really think that the country was more wholesome and sisters who lived in the city were polluted or something? But it's true, like she believed that, and a lot of them believed even worse than that. I was mildly aware of some sisters' dissatisfaction with certain discrepancies between provinces and obtaining permission. The fact that the then General Council, CLT, lived in the Northern Province and that the Mother House was in the Northern Province had an influence. Some felt that we had a two-pronged leadership, and we did. And the story goes that many sisters, I shouldn't say many, some sisters got on the train or the bus or the whatever at 3:30 when school finished and they came into Mount Street to tell the Superior General something that was wrong in the house without saying it was going to the Provincial first or the Superior or the whoever, whatever. And it's interesting, and one of the sisters said, and of course the Superior General actually thought she was in charge, and she said, and she would take it on board until Sister Elizabeth Murphy's time, and Liz Murphy said, have you been to your provincial about that? And Sister would say no, and she said, well, I don't want to hear it. And that was the problem with New South Wales. Nobody in the whole congregation understood that. Anyway, another one. This one, I think, is really interesting because it's different from... It's different because it's saying the problem wasn't with provinces. As I recall the period, I believe there were some areas of tension, but my perception was that the major challenges arose within communities rather than between provinces. These tensions were located around, and these are the issues that came up in the second section in the provincial and congregational chapters. The tensions were located around the implementation of changes proposed by the 1968 Special General Chapter. In matters such as times of prayer and silence, community review, new understandings of the nature and exercise of authority, and regrettably, far less significant matters such as position of hemlines, the showing of hair, the decision of individual choice, for example, colour of one's hosiery, these latter had a very different divisive effect on communities. So, what I'm saying, like a lot of important issues, like when we prayed, how we prayed, where you prayed, because we all had to be in the chapel. And all of these rules came from canon law. So when you need to change these, it's really very difficult. And some of the sisters who were on the chapter, I never went on the chapter because I took my name off the list every time. I couldn't bear it, actually. And One of the sisters said she saw a sister going around and looking at all the bits of paper that someone had put in as to why we shouldn't change the habit. And she said, like, it was a really very important thing, you see. And so was the colour of your hair, and so was your hair, and so was the length of the habit. We had a criteria which was the Ajax tin, and we had a Jesuit in Australia who came to work with us. What was his name? Ralph Hughes. And Ralph Hughes said, oh, I can't remember, I won't look in there, I know exactly what he said. And he worked with us, and I wrote to him and said, I remember you were here working with the sisters, and he told me how many days he was here and how many months he was here and what he did, and he said, the thing that really floored me, he said, was the Ajax tin for the length of the habit. Because you had to, it had to be an Ajax tin from the ground, you see. And he said it was really wonderful because in one community that he was working with, he said one really, really naughty sister, she flaunted that and wouldn't do it, you see. And on a Saturday morning, seriously, on a Saturday morning when you came down at breakfast, I think breakfast was a bit freer on Saturday morning than it was any other day, and someone would say, you're going to Mount Street, are you? Because she had the Ajax tin height for a habit. And if you didn't have the Ajax tin, it would be up your half calf, see, and then you were going somewhere else. Now, look, we laugh about it now, and it's hilarious. But it really mattered to some people. And I was reprimanded. No, I wasn't reprimanded. We didn't have to wear our veils in the house, but we had to wear them in ministry. And so you know, Mary, about these same things, aren't they? We're all mad, but never mind. We're all mad together. And I didn't wear my veil because I was doing a course and it wasn't ministry, so I didn't wear my veil. And then when I got a job at that place, that was ministry, you see, so I should have worn my veil. And one of the senior sisters at Mount Street said to me, she said, you don't wear your veil, do you? And I said, no, I don't, Grandma. I used to call her Grandma because she watered my plants and she was a lovely lady. And so I tried to tell her and I thought, this is a waste of time. So I said, no, I don't, actually. The next day, the Superior General sent for me and she lived in on the property, Mount Street this was. And I went over and I said, I know exactly what you're going to ask me, Liz, why I don't wear my veil to ministry. And she said, I said, because Grandma's just already asked me. And she said, well, yes, she said, I was just wondering, Catherine. And I said, look, veils historically have been a symbol of oppression. They've been a symbol of seduction. I said, but they've never been a symbol of commitment. I said, a ring is always a symbol of commitment, I said. And we never talk about our ring. It's never it's never discussed at chapters. I said, but we always discuss that bit of rag we stick on our heads. And I said, and anyway, Liz, I went down the backyard and I burnt them all. And I said to her, but if you tell me to put it on again, I worshipped Liz Murphy. I really did. And I said, if you tell me to put it on again, I will. And I said, but I don't think you'll waste your time, will you? And she just looked at me and she said, did you want a cup of coffee? So I had a cup of coffee and I came back to her. Like we were sitting there and I said to her, listen, you haven't got your veil on now, have you, Liz? And she said, no. I said, because you're not in ministry, are you? I said, you are, actually, because you're leading the congregation. And I said, and when you come over to lunch over at the mother house on Sunday, I said, you all put your veils on, all of you, all six of you. I said, it would be really helpful to us if you didn't. So sure enough, next Sunday, they all come over with their veils off. And I gave her a poke and I said, thanks very much. She said, you're welcome. Now, that was the kind of leadership we had in Liz Murphy. Extraordinary woman. For 12 years we had her and things moved. Now, that's not saying other people didn't do it before her. They did. Mother Dennis Earle, who was the brother, sister, no, she had a brother, a priest, MSC, was he? Yes, he was, an MSC in New Guinea. And I remember Wally Black saying to me, Mother Dennis came and sat in my office and in tears she said, Father, help me move the sisters forward. you know, and that was long before Liz Murphy. So there were great women who were there, but I just happened to like Liz Murphy. I think that, what's his name? Ralph Hughes, the Jesuit, also was in working with the Wollongong Canberra Goulburn Diocese, and he was at the Dominican House in Canberra, and the Wollongong Canberra Goulburn Sisters were assembled there, and his first question was, I'd like you to write down the sins of the order. And there was a sister there, and she's the one who spoke. It's in here somewhere. And she said, I nearly fainted. It was absolutely wonderful. She said, so someone wrote up the sins, Josephite sins, on the wall. Or book. And then this sister said, can we have him back again? Because it was a wonderful experience for her of moving from that to this. And I think that says a lot about the change. Oh, another one. This is really, again, about two provinces. And again, it was canon law. When the question of sisters attending sacraments received by members of the sister's family arose, Dr. Connolly, the resident canon lawyer at the gathering, said, religious could attend the nuptial mass, but not the wedding reception. It's canon law. Mad. Absolutely mad. And then there was and the example this sister gives, that she was in a country convent and a priest was being ordained, and his sister, who was one of our Josephites, she was coming to the ordination. Now, the sisters in the community were going to the ordination, but they were probably the choir if it was Glen Innes, and they were going to the reception in the town hall afterwards. But the sister of the brother, was not allowed to go to the reception, you see. And one of the... Seriously, because you couldn't go. That's what canon law said, you see. The sister continued, recognising this as a scandalous situation, I took it on myself to phone Mother Dennis and acquaint her of this situation. She gave permission for the sister of the newly ordained priest to also attend the luncheon with the sisters of the local community, and indicated she would follow up with the provincial. The comment from this sister after this was, this is one example of how discrepancies occurred from province to province within New South Wales. Situation became even more apparent when permission depended on which side of the Hume Highway you happened to live. Which is true. Like you're laughing, and I laugh too, because it's true. This is what happened. And I think some of the things that the sisters are actually saying is, and I was glad I lived through this tension. Because you were, actually. There were some very quirky things that happened in religious life. And one of them was, when I was a postulant, I was told that the extraordinary confessor was coming tomorrow, you see. I thought, what in the hell is an extraordinary confessor? And I said, what do you do with an extraordinary confessor? They said, you've got to have extraordinary sins. They said, where was I? Woodburn. I was living with two sisters. And without, you know, a smile on their face, they said, you've got to have extraordinary sins. And I went, I really hadn't a clue. But Mother Dennis, that one I just spoke about, Mother Dennis said at one of the chapters, it is the responsibility of the superior to invite an extraordinary confessor, and her responsibility ends there. Which is an interesting understanding, isn't it? You know, it's her job to get the fella, and when he comes, if nobody goes to him, that's good. And there were many people who interpreted the law in that way. Great people, really. Some other funny little bits about our life. Watchers had to have black leather bands, you see. Not too sure what that's got to do with spirituality. I've got a brown one on this watch. If you wanted to use an umbrella or boots or fountain pens, and this is written in the customs, not the constitutions, they could be used provided it was no expense to the congregation. That's exactly what's written. Mother Leone wore boots all her life. Not too sure whether she got permission or something, whatever. I'm not denigrating our life. I'm just saying these are the mad things that went on. And they were all because we were dictated to by canon law. One sister, this shows how sensible some people were. There was a sister in Liam, 1940s. She was a 21-year-old Irish girl who came to Australia, and eventually she entered. And she remembers getting some money from her family at home. And there was a sister on the leadership team, Casimir Meskell. Great lady, really. She was Irish too. And Liam went to Casimir and she said to her, like, I've got this money from... And we had to put in money, anything we got, put it in wherever it went, you know, into the kitty or something. And Casimir said to her, get a mass head for your parents and spend the rest. Now that kind of thing was there, and we need to concentrate on those good things rather than the others. Intoxicating drink, oh, that's so good. We weren't allowed to have intoxicating. But we could if we got the bishop's permission, you see. And the Federation sisters, who have since joined us, but that's a long story, Federation sisters had to even go to the bishop to get permission to go to the doctor. Don't know whether he accompanied them or not, but anyway. And this is the last funny... clothing needs, you see. You had to put the clothing, your needs, on a piece of paper in the superior's office at Christmas time. No colours or anything, it's just the size, you see. So I put my name down, Robert in those days, Robert Tidman, whatever, all this, whatever I needed. And they would be bought from Mark Foy's. I think Mark Foy's ripped us off. I'm sorry about that. They did, actually. But if you were in a country district, the superior probably went down the street to get what you needed. And I'm sure someone told me this, and I think it might have been Glen Innes, and there'd been about 17 or 18 sisters in the community there. And the superior went down the street with all the lists, you know, my name and everybody else's name and exactly what size they had, and she lost the list. She lost all... Oh, dear, so that was some of the things that kind of happened to us. In the year 2000, this is probably quite important, the year 2000, Anne Derwent was provincial, and it was a year of reconciliation. So she decided to, and there's a beautiful thing in here about the sisters who were mourning the sisters who left. It's quite moving, actually. Said by them, not me. And she decided to invite the former Josephites to a meal out at that race place out at Rouse Hill or somewhere. Rose Hill, right, okay. Very few sisters came. And if you went and you saw these people hanging around outside the door, you knew that they were hesitant to come in, I understand it. My own sister never came to them. And the sister who edited all of this twice... she was a former Josephite, and she never came either. So I can understand why they didn't, but the attempt was there on Anne's part to bring them together. Later on, Judy Sipple decided that for the 10th anniversary of the beatification of Mary MacKillop, she would do it again, and there were far more sisters there. Judy addressed them, and she addressed everyone as sisters all, which was really an interesting way of addressing people. And in between, there was a space between the courses, and everybody just got up and walked around and went to each other. You know, there were hundreds of us there, which was really lovely. The ladies were asked how they felt about sisters all, and said, for me, being addressed as sisters all was the highlight of the evening. I know now I'm not an ex-Josephite, I'm part of an extended sisterhood. Another sister said, thank you for your vision in making this possible. These gestures build so much goodwill and understanding and do much to heal and bring hope to those who still feel a measure of pain. And I know this one, another sister who said this. More was achieved than just a meal together. It was the renewing of long, dearly held friendships. The chance to catch up with so many, be it ever so short, was incredible. The many remember when were mind-boggling. I have many things to be grateful for. Teacher training, without which I would not have been able to get a living. Self-discipline, yep. You'd have to know this person. Owe that to the congregation. And boy, oh boy, did we learn how to housekeep. I think I will just finish with some of the positive things that sisters have said. And these would be about the whole process. I've only looked about section one, but section two is where the changes are actually analysed. And they're momentous changes, actually. One sister said, "I'm grateful that subsequent province and congregational chapters have continued to bring more personal involvement in community, province and even congregational levels." Another one, "We now have greater opportunity for education. I experienced a sense that we were moving forward, more freedom and responsibility, opportunity to choose our retreats each year, availability of spiritual direction." Another one, "Looking back, the changes were gradual and took time to filter through to some communities, while others were more dynamic." And I love this one. "Gradually, one came to be one's own person again." And finished with this, another sister said, "For me, the main conversation point of our congregation was under the leadership of Elizabeth Murphy, 1977-89, and her team. It seemed as though the windows were open and the cobwebs blown away. I felt a new spirit was emerging and we began a movement away from the non-essentials, like hair and whatever. I felt so blessed that I've lived in the tense times and been given the gift to live through them. I'm now enjoying the freedom that's been given me as a to be treated as a normal human woman." She went on, "We never got it right, but for me it's been an amazing, transformative lived experience. Thank you."
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I'm sure that that will provoke a lot of questions and discussion and comment, whether or not you went to a Jesuit school or not. But what you said about the division between provinces has its larger aspect as well. I can remember when I was working in Munich. On Friday night, I was driving down to with a friend who was a German Munich lawyer to visit his parents in a place called Offenburg, which was on the French border. And apropos of nothing at all, as we sped down the Autobahn, he said to me, "That man whom you call, you English speakers call Charlemagne, and we call Karl de Grosse, was he French or German?" And suspecting that this was coming from a lawyer and therefore a trick question, I said, "I have no idea." We drove it in silence for a little while. He gave me time to think. And I said, "Eki, I've got no idea. What's the answer?" And he said, "Oh, it depended on what side of the Rhine you were born on." So it's not just religious orders, it's nationalities and populations as well. And what you said certainly makes the much-vaunted federal-state political differences seem trivial, really.
Well, it's underlaid by religion. That's the problem, isn't it?
Catherine, I'm one of the people, I think, who didn't comment on your use of poetry in the book. I wondered whether you might read one of the poems or quote from one and say how it spoke to you and why.
Well, one of them is really important for me. And it does sum up, I think, significant happenings in people's lives. "Morning was gently breaking its day colour. I stood high, waking land below, sounding day life. Night clouds above, changing in light. I was warmed by the beauty of day birth, a simple everyday happening, and yet it was as though I had never been there before. I felt so good, I could smell the newness, hear the promise, face the risk, stand strong in the salvation of the coming sun. I became aware of myself. I looked at my hands and touched the meaning of my own creation. There were timelines on my face and many years of memories to remember. Why so long before I found myself a breathing piece of the beauty of being? Yes, healing and changing I need. That hope is promised. But before the need and hope, there was and is the created gift of person within the frame I am. I met myself that morning. It was a birth breaking for me, and the newly given day I honoured." And I think in saying that, I think that's what summed up for a lot of sisters what went on. They knew there was pain. They went through the pain. They found themselves, and as that one sister said, I became myself again.
Would you like to comment on the pastoral role of the sisters in the lives of communities and of parishes, and you know, they brought a unique presence that you know, priests and other people couldn't bring, and that's lost now to, you know, the church in Australia on a big scale.
Thank you for that. I think it's true. I don't know, and I'm not saying. I think there's a contribution to be made by the feminine and the masculine. I really do believe that, and I think there was something about Mary MacKillop, whom I also love, that was pragmatic, but it was also, apart from the fact that it was challenging the institution, but it was something that the bishops didn't understand. And I know they were trained in Ireland, and I understand that they understand religious life as being all in one container, you know, with great high walls, and you didn't go anywhere. And many of the bishops made comments like, they're out there running around the streets. That was about us. And they couldn't cope with that, and it was a totally different presence, I think. I think something might be what you're saying, that there's a different presence between lay people. Well, we're lay people too, actually. But there was some, and I think sometimes it was overplayed and it was misunderstood, so that it's like with priests. You know, they're up on a pedestal, and God help you if they fall down, you know. And it's the same with us. If they find out that we're human and female and feminine and got all the problems that go with that, I just think it's kind of disillusioning people. But I think what you're saying is true. One, there aren't enough of us to be our presence anymore. And that's why a lot of priests have said, look, I don't care if you don't go into the school, don't care if you don't, just come and be among the parishioners. And that's what a lot of our sisters are doing. Like, they're out in Gilgandra and God knows where, and they're probably doing nothing, in one sense, but they are a presence. And I think presences are really important, and they add to the qualitative presence, you know, of a parish. Not too sure whether every priest experiences that or sees the need for it. I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question.
I'm a bit confused about the power structures. Power is very an important topic in church these days. You spoke about the power between the provincial people and the general...
Congregational
head. Where did you get the personnel that became congregational heads? Weren't they from all the different provinces?
Yes.
Why weren't they more sympathetic and compassionate and understanding of what was going on? Oh, they were deaf.
Go on, sorry.
I knew those habits. But that just didn't spill over onto them, as they were just there to serve the order, really, and bring it together.
I think they were ordinary human beings with all the failures. And they were elected or whatever, and they may not have had any leadership qualities. They may not have been sorted out in themselves. You know, they may have had all those human foibles, which don't help in a leadership role. They are elected, but then I also have question marks about the election process. You know, some, we had just had it recently, some sisters take their names off lists. I do it every time. Like a list comes out of all the sisters who are right age or tiddlywinks or whatever, and I just say, take my name off the list, thank you. I'm a coward. No, I'm not. I am, yeah. I I probably have high expectations of myself and everybody else, unfortunately, and therefore I take my name off the list. And I admire those who leave their names on the list. I really do. But some of them I wish they didn't. Yeah, but it's a case of, do I know myself? You know, do I know I have leadership qualities? Can I teach science? No. Can I teach? Yes. You know, and they're the questions we need to ask ourselves in or out of religious life.
Just a quick question. To what extent was the beatification, canonisation process of Mary MacKillop the result of this growing sense of unity and the breakdown of, you know, some of these old ways? Or was the canonisation in itself a stimulus for change, great change?
I wasn't in authority. I have never been in authority. There was a process that was thought to be necessary at the beginning, and then people started to do research about what contribution Mary had made to the church. That was a bit faulty, but never mind. I think there was an enormous fear. I know there was. Enormous fear that we had to get this done, otherwise something might happen, you know, something might turn up. And I think all institutions, seriously, have got to look at themselves now in terms of people saying, you did this and you did that, and Sister So-and-so did this. And I remember Judy saying quite seriously at a Province Day, she said, you know, I had a letter the other day, and it was from a staff member in X school, she didn't say, and she said, and the woman said to me, Sister So-and-so did not speak to me in the corridor this morning. So anything that can take from the contribution you're making is sad. But I hope we got back to looking at the charism rather than saying, isn't this wonderful, we've got a saint, you know. Don't think we have it at all, actually. But I would like to think we looked back and said, what did Mary say about this? And how can we put that into practice now? And are we? Which is a worse question to ask, actually. Because the beatification and that was just a church thing, you know, and it was that some of the hoops you had to go through in order to get whatever you got, and we got a saint, and the whole of Australia got a saint.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I've always wondered about the people who split from the Mary MacKillop Josephites, and there was a whole group at Bathurst, wasn't there? They went with the bishop. Are they back reunited with you now?
Yes, that was a tragic time, it really was. And it was mainly the bishops. We blame the bishops all the time, don't we?
With good cause.
I didn't say that. Yes, they did. Bathurst was the beginning, and Sister Hyacinth was the only one who stayed in Bathurst. Darling, lovely Scottish lady, she died. And all the rest came back to Mary. They had a choice. Many of the sisters out in the country didn't have a choice at all until later. So Bathurst founded Lochinvar, Goulburn, Tasmania, Wanganui, I think that's all. And then so Tasmania, Goulburn, Perthville, Wanganui all came back. No, they didn't. And I think it's a bit like the Sisters of Mercy. You know, the Sisters of Mercy had one of these thingy-bobs too, and North Sydney didn't join in, and Parramatta didn't, and Brisbane didn't. So I don't understand why. I don't care, actually. Some of the people who didn't know what Mary said and what Julian said, or they misunderstood what they said, said that we came together for the simple reason that Mary and Julian wanted it. But Julian wanted it under his rule before it was changed by Rome. So, like, that was the misunderstanding there. But I think the Goulburn sisters were thinking about this for decades before they came. And it was one sister from Bega, who was pushing it. It's called fusion according to canon law. A darling friend of mine that I worked with for 30-something years, she just said something and I said, listen, love, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. I said, you'll be buried up there if you want to be buried up there. I said, no one will ask you to come down to Sydney or whatever, whatever. And she said, but Catherine, we've lost our history. And I went, oh, God. I didn't understand that. I really didn't. So the history doesn't exist for those sisters who are fused, canonically, according to the canon laws. And there's pain, a hell of a lot of pain. Sorry, I don't, they won't like me for saying that, but it's true. Sorry.
Thanks very much, sister. Just on the general question, the church's problems in recent times and horrors in recent times have all been male. Women, particularly nuns above all, have come up smelling roses. Yes, well, you say some of them. I'm thinking that my grandfather was the doctor to every priest but another in Queensland, as far as I can work out. And he told me various stories about priest brothers and nuns and things they had done. But they were nearly always sad, pathetic stories. Hmm. You know, He's a doctor and he's called into a nun who's been found dead in her bed. He has to do the autopsy. He finds out she's pregnant. Hmm.
Yep.
And so on. Those sorts of stories.
Yes, yeah.
But generally, could you sort of comment on the way in which nuns' reputation has stayed so very high within the Catholic community and within, I'd say, the wider Australian community?
The answer's no, probably. We have a sister who is solely responsible for looking at all our institutions, our orphanages and whatevers and whatevers. Mary keeps things to herself. But she has to front any questions that come. And that's in one sense to save us, so that if a question comes about me, no one in the congregation is allowed to answer it except Mary. So I don't know. I don't really know. I think we would have been in trouble for bullying and pushing and, you know, slapping kids and if that happened. And I don't know why you're saying we've come up smelling roses. I know why you're saying it, but I've got no answer for it, I'm sorry. I fear, even today at 84, I fear someone saying that I hit them or something. I really do. And I don't know how many others do, but I live in fear. I do, actually, seriously.
Catherine, could you tell us a bit more about the Irish novitiate.
In Ireland?
The Irish novitiate for your sister.
That was the juniorate, you mean?
Yeah. When does it run, from where to where?
Oh, I don't know, Ed.
Ah.
I can't. It's in here. It's in there.
I'll read it.
No, I'm sorry. That's an interesting issue because the sisters who came out in that earlier period, 1870s, 80s, whatever, they would have come out as ordinary women with their families. They didn't come out to enter. They came across Josephites and then they were attracted by Mary's charism and they came. Now, once the juniorate started at wherever, Newmarket, once the juniorate started, that's where I think there probably wasn't sufficient, go back, because we were desperately in need of teachers, right? I think we did what most juniorates would have done and taken in anybody, right? Those people then had two or three years training in Ireland, and I don't know what the Irish education system was, but they would have completed whatever it was there, and then they came to us, and then they entered. Our junior at Hunters Hill would have done the leaving. Right. We would have just had people do the leaving and then they would have entered from there. So the same pattern would have, I think, like the pressure that people were under to put a body in front of a classroom meant that not sufficient work was done to see if they were suitable. Now, the only division we would have had was she didn't get the leaving, so we put her in the kitchen, you know, and I'm making that up, actually. But I think that sadly is what happened to a number of sisters. Or that if they wanted to be nurses, that was different. But we had a number of sisters who've been in, we've got nice names for it now, internal ministry or something. But it was because they weren't educated enough to be in schools.
Supplementary question, Catherine. What numbers are we talking about?
Then or now?
No, now. Then. Were they ever a big group inside the Josephites?
They were, actually.
Right. Yes, I was taught by Irish nuns.
Yeah. I don't know the statistics.
Thank you.
There were quite a number. We had an Irish embassy at Burwood, you know. They took over the convent at Burwood for the summer holidays.
From Ireland, and I do remember the Josephites coming round looking for us young people to join.
Yes.
And that was a thing you did around Ireland, which was quite surprising, because our towns were all nuns. Schools were run by the nuns or the brothers. So you weren't allowed. You weren't allowed coming. You had to go out to the country. And I remember coming out to the country where I was in a small school in the country, and the master was sending somebody up on a bicycle to my mother saying, "God's sake, the nuns have arrived. Will you do them lunch? Come down in the car and take them up for lunch." Yeah. every year or twice a year this would happen.
Mm.
But I wondered why you came so far to collect girls, to bring them back.
Probably the influence of the Irish Church in Australia. We set up a house.
It was the Josephites, yeah.
We set up a house there in Ireland to educate them and bring them out, and some of them came out at 13.
Yeah, but the ones that I know that came out here that I have caught up with now were 17 and 18 coming out.
Yes, yes.
Their fathers promised them so much that they didn't go, but they didn't. The money would be there if they wanted to come back and work as hairdressers and whatnot, if they left the order. Because it was like going to the end of the earth. We used to sing, "Go ye afar, teach ye all nations," and we waved the handkerchiefs.
The mission. That was the misunderstanding of the whole missionary thing. That's what they were doing, and they thought they were coming out to teach the Aborigines. Many of them thought that. I remember being at a conference in Ireland, and I said to, again, my Episcopal friend, I said, "Look, I was in Ireland," and I said, and there were 500 Irish women there. I said, and they're all intelligent and da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, and I've never lived with one of them. And his response was, "They came out when they were 13 and they still don't know who they are." And I think that's true. And one of the sisters said to me, darling, I love her dearly, and she said to me, "Thank you," when she read my thesis, she said, "Thank you for explaining my culture to me." So it's like the Aborigines. You know, if you leave home when you're, even if it's from Germany or Lithuania or whoever, if you leave home when you're 13 and you haven't been deeply embedded in your culture, you're like the poor Aboriginal people. You know, they're now learning their languages. They're now understanding their culture. They're now knowing where they come from. And I don't think many of our Irish sisters ever did.
But worse than that, Catherine, some of what you said earlier sounded to me, and I never was in a religious order at all, so that's you can take it or leave it. But some of what you said yourself and in the interchanges imply that some of the religious orders regarded it, perhaps some of the priestly training also regarded it as their imperative to break the spirit of the people coming in, to stop them from being who they were, so they were a kind of stereotype product, and wouldn't disgrace the organisation, but wouldn't be troublemakers either.
I do think it's based on a misunderstanding of the theology of religious life, basically. You know, you do break them, and I don't think that's a good thing to do. And that's why I think Vatican II has been a blessing, because we've begun to say that's not the way to do it. To humiliate people is not the way to do it. It's not even the way now. But it happened, and it happened because many of those people understood that that's what religious life was about. I don't think it was about it at all. And I just think I was anaesthetised most of the time, so I didn't know what was going on anyway. So I kind of went through it, but I do think it came from a poor understanding of the theology of religious life. You break people.
I often think of the extraordinary influence the Sisters of Mercy, particularly, and the Joeys, particularly the Brown Joeys, what a tremendous influence they have been on Australian Catholics through their education. Ed and I have been educated in our early school life by Mercy Sisters and Josephites. Now, I don't know whether you see this story that I sometimes think of that I heard, don't know whether it's true or not. It was after a conference many years ago in Rome of canon lawyers. And at the conclusion of the conference, they went to a lunch together. And the it was on a Friday, in the days when we didn't eat meat on Fridays. They're in Rome, an Italian restaurant. And the story goes that the, I don't know whether to say, Anglo-Saxon canon lawyers said, we can have meat today because we're celebrating the end of the conference. And the Celts said, no, we have to keep the law, which is don't eat meat on Friday. And I sometimes think that we're influenced in Australia, including in the church, including religious life, to sort of worship law in tiny ways, if you like. Yeah. So I see it as related to what you've said, but not everybody would, I guess.
I think there is some truth in that. We were very much under the influence of the Irish, but not the free Irish, you know. Like, not the Irish as they understand themselves.
Well, I think we've kept Catherine on her feet long enough, so we'll draw formal discussion to a close and welcome informal conversation with her amongst ourselves over coffee and biscuits and tea. So thank you very much indeed, Catherine.
Sister Catherine had been on her feet for an hour and a half when we closed the meeting, but she kindly consented to responding to two more questions over a cuppa. The first questioner suggested that there was a hidden agenda of proselytisation in the coming of Irish sisters on mission to Australia to teach or to nurse.
Yes, I think that was an understanding. Now, the point about the Irish understanding of missionary was the missionaries, the Irish, and this is Colum Kill and Colum Barnes and all of those great men, they went in response to God without any oars on their boats or whatever, and when they landed somewhere, that's where God wanted them to be. And that's it. That's missionary. If there were people there who asked them what they were doing, they would share the scriptures and the gospel with them. But it wasn't an intention to go and bring them to the faith. And I think that's where the Irish, the proselytising came in. It's a misunderstanding of the whole fundamental notion of missionary. Missionary is when you go at the response of God to where God wants you. That's it.
Yes. And there was this conversion.
Oh, yes. They're going to save their soul, you see. Superiors in religious convents were about to save our souls too.
Yeah,
and I remember saying to one sister, terrible, wasn't it? She said something about being in the chapel half an hour before Mass or whatever, and I said to her, listen, it's a breakfast. I said, look, thanks very much for that. I said, but look, you're not responsible for my salvation. I said, if I want to go to hell, I'll go, regardless of what you do. And I was trying to say, look, I'm letting you off the hook,
yes.
You know. But they did. Like, superiors thought that. Parish priests thought they were responsible for the salvation of all their flock, you know. So there was no freedom.
The second questioner asked,
if St. MacKillop or Mary MacKillop were to have appeared today, listen to your paper, what do you think she would have made of it, and how would she decipher the transformational period that you have underlined in this book?
I think my inspiration comes from her, and I'm a Scot too, as she is.
Yes.
And there's a pragmatism in the Scots as well as all the other wonderful characteristics of the Celts. I think she was a woman who was capable of change and instigating change, but it was change based on solid foundations, solid philosophy and solid theology. So I think she'd be quite comfortable. I talk to her every night when I have my whiskey.
Oh, okay.
I do. Seriously, I've got a stunning photo, my photo, but it's done in Vietnamese silk screen.
Oh, okay.
And it's absolutely beautiful. And so she sits over there and I just say to her, well, what have we done today, love? and I'll say to her, just fix that up. You know, just fix it up, please. So I think she'd be quite comfortable. I really do.
Okay.
But it's not the Mary that many of our sisters know, you see.
We've been listening to From Taproot to Rhizome, Sister Catherine Tom, RSJ, reflecting on changes in governance of Josephites of the New South Wales province in response to the reforms of the Second Vatican Council and the need at that time and since for changes in outlook and to involve the sisters more directly in making decisions affecting themselves and their ministry. The Q&A which followed the talk was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It all took place on Sunday the 18th of June in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Churchill, Sydney, Australia. Of course, the talk barely scratches the surface of the book, From Taproot to Rhizome, a solid work of 14 chapters and 358 pages with index, published in 2022 by the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart. The book is subtitled A Study of Post-Vatican II Changes in the Lives and Experiences of a Group of Women Religious from 1968 to 2008. This ACHS talk was recorded on Gadigal lands and the podcast produced on Wallumedegal lands by me, John Kenny. The Society acknowledges the traditional owners of the places upon which we record and make the podcast or in which our stream may be heard. On Sunday, the 16th of July 2023, our talk at St. Pat's is entitled Catholic Culture Wars, and the speaker will be Andrew West. Andrew is the presenter of ABC Radio National's Religion and Ethics Report, and he was formerly New South Wales State Political Editor for the Sydney Morning Herald. You are welcome to join us then for more history. Bye for now.